Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 5th of February. Our guest this hour will answer a number of questions, and she does so in such an entertaining fashion in her new book. Why is it that we have changed in how tall we are? Human beings have changed, and Native Americans, when Columbus first came here, were much taller than Columbus. Why is that the case? And are we growing? And why are the tallest people in a certain part of Europe? Why do we have hair? I've always wondered this. Why is most of, we got this tuft of hair on the top of our head. Why don't we have hair all over our bodies? And we wonder that a lot in Wisconsin when it's really, really cold outside. What are our knees? What about our knees? Background of our knees and our hearing and our eyes. And, well, what our guest has done is looked at human beings. And she's the author of The Well-Dressed Ape, A Natural History of Myself. Hannah Holmes is a science reporter. She's also author of Suburban Safari and The Secret Life of Dust. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Los Angeles Times, Discover Outside, and many other publications. She's a frequent contributor on science and nature subjects for the Discovery Channel online. And one of the reviews of this book is that it's careful science meeting good writing and is a pleasure. So she studied spent a great deal of time studying the human body, and she's also studied a lot of other animals as well. It's just chock full of fascinating conversation. I'm going to welcome phone calls for her, as always happens. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you have a burning question or something grabs your fancy during this hour. Hi, Hannah. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. Great to be with you.
Yeah, it's great to be with you. It's just such an entertaining read. I was interrupting my husband all last night. I say, Michael, do you know this? Do you know this? I was just, because there's so many fascinating facts in this book, that things you've thought about and you don't know the answer, and you found the answer here.
Yeah, the human is a really bizarre animal, and it was really fun to just take a step back and look at it like an animal and figure out what makes us tick.
Exactly. And so you start with yourself actually naked in front of a mirror looking at your body, right?
Yep. yeah, that was awkward, even though all the blinds were drawn.
I'm sure it was.
A New England Yankee, and we like to pretend we don't have bodies. So even just standing there by myself, it was pretty horrifying.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's important to take a look at how this animal really works. I mean, for a mammal, it's very, very bizarre.
Right.
To end up on the back 2 feet holding the front ones up in the air.
Exactly. Can we talk about the hair? Because I've wondered about this for so long, and finally you wrote about it. Why is the major, we've got hair follicles all over the place, tons of them, but we got this tuft of hair on our heads. Why?
Yeah, big bushy poof of a fur right on the top of the animal. And tons of hair follicles, as you said, more than a chimpanzee. And a chimpanzee has fur all over its body. And we do have fur all over the body. It's just tiny, tiny little vellus hairs that are kind of transparent. So the theories as to why we just went berserk with the fur on the head include the notion that the brain needs to be insulated.
Hmm.
The human brain is super-duper hot, actually. It burns 1 out of 5 of the calories you ingest.
Hmm.
That thing uses a lot of energy, and it throws off a lot of waste heat. But one of the theories is that you need to insulate it from the heat and cold as well, because it's always also fairly delicate.
Right. It is an astounding piece of work, isn't it, the human brain?
Well, when you think about all the deficits that it has to compensate for, just for an example, consider the human's weapon system, what it uses to defend itself and to catch prey. And to do this, just look at your little fingernails there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Not all that impressive.
No.
One's going to run in terror if you curl your claws at them. And the other weapon we have is our canine teeth, which have really kind of devolved into these itty-bitty stumps. Look at a real canine tooth in the mouth of your household canine.
Right.
And it's like an inch long, and they use it just as chimpanzees do. Our closest relatives have very respectable canine teeth, and they use them to bite the stuffing out of each other.
Right.
Humans gave up the biting and the scratching, and we use tools. And for that, you need a good-sized brain.
Huh. We can still use canine teeth, though, don't you, to chew things better?
Well, the canine teeth are a little bit like spears. That's what their shape tells us they're for, is for spearing things. So the incisors in the front of the mouth are for slicing, and the molars at the back are for grinding. And this tells us that the human evolved as an omnivore. We have the tooth style of things like pigs that evolved to eat everything. And we do eat everything.
Right.
But the canine teeth are meant to be weapons. Mm-hmm. And so while we use them to sort of puncture tough foods, that's about all they're good for.
Right. What about differences? You spend some time in this, and certainly science is evolving in this area. The differences between male and female brains.
Huge. Like they're in two different animals completely. And I find it so amazing that the brains can be structured in such different ways and feature really different cell types even. So males, in some really crucial areas for thinking, have 7 times more gray matter than females do. And females, in the same crucial thinking areas, have 9 times more white matter. These are very different cell types with very different jobs.
Hmm.
Gray matter sort of manages information. White matter transfers it from place to place.
So that
completely different organization, and yet we can all read books and drive cars. So the two brains, as different as they are, work just the same.
Interesting. Are there areas, though, that make females better because of their brain size? They're better doing a certain task or thinking in a certain way than male brains, and vice versa?
Most of the cliches that we're used to are really overblown. We're all accustomed to hearing that yada yada about women say 9,000 more words in a day than men do, that kind of thing.
Right.
But a recent study just took a very simple approach and stuck recorders on people and then counted how many words they actually say, and we all say the same number.
How many?
Yes, I forget what it was, maybe 14,000. So really no difference there, and that's probably true with many of the cliche differences. There are a few established differences, and they're fairly small, but the male brain does excel at mental rotation of an object in space.
What good is that?
Well, now the female brain excels at navigating the world by landmarks. And when you think about how this might have evolved, the feeding styles of this animal in the environment where we evolved was that the female was pretty much always tied down with infants and toddlers. You can't go hunt gazelles if you've got a screaming kid on your back or hanging onto your hand.
Mm-hmm.
So the female foraging style is based on stationary, reliable, trustworthy plants. So females navigate from the tuber patch to the fruit tree to the grain field. They go by landmarks.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
Of course, unencumbered by the screamy memes, can tiptoe off and hunt game. And game, unlike the fruit tree, moves around. So the male has to be able to rotate objects in space, so to speak, in order to remember which direction is home. Because if he doesn't get home with the meat, his child isn't going to do as well and may not live to pass on his DNA.
So is it a wash as to who has a better sense of direction, or does one serve one better in a certain environment than another?
That's exactly it. They seem to be different ways of solving the same problem. And I mean, we all know this. As females, that to this day, we can locate the jar of mayonnaise in the fridge, even from our office at work, when the male in the household calls and says, "We're out of mayonnaise."
Right.
And we say, "Open the door, go past the butter, and take a right at the eggs."
Does that also explain, or is it just a peculiarity in my household and others that I've talked to, that males have a tendency to ask where everything is all the time? You know, where's this? Where's the male? And it's true of the older men in the family and the young men in the family. They can't seem to find anything.
You know, nobody, besides this one difference about navigating by landmarks versus sort of dead reckoning, all we can do is theorize and conjecture. And that's very amusing to do, because it does seem to show up in our lives that that the males have, you know, they can get across town without a map, but they can't find the butter.
Right, exactly. So let's evolve a little bit. You go down the hole. We'll go to the ears and eyes in a moment. But what's the story with mammary glands in women? Why are they pronounced always? Why don't they just sort of recede when they're not needed?
Yeah, you know, I've often asked myself that when I'm jogging.
Right.
On most mammals, the female mammary glands only inflate when she's nursing.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the pups or kits or whatever grow up, the things get out of the way, they deflate and sort of vanish. The female human keeps them inflated at all times. The theories for this include that the fat that's stored in the mammary glands, they're mainly fat, is an advertisement of the female's fitness for reproduction. So she's telling males visually that she has enough calories stored up to gestate and then support nursing an infant, which can be 2, 3, 4 years worth of energetic investment on her part.
Mm-hmm.
So she needs to make a show that she's ready to do this.
Hmm. You think that's true?
It's sort of the soundest theory. The most amusing theory, which was put forth by the original ape book, the Naked Ape, is highly amusing and highly speculative, and I think not terribly appropriate. But his theory, Desmond Morris, was that the mammary glands are meant to mimic the buttocks and therefore inspire mating urges both coming and going.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that one's pretty out there, isn't it? Yeah. And why do men have nipples?
Yeah, why do they?
I don't know.
male animals of all sorts in the mammal class have nipples. This is one of the strange things about evolution, is that if you have a feature, but it doesn't cost you anything, it doesn't weigh you down, you don't have to eat more to support it, there's no reason for it to evolve away.
Hmm.
So perhaps mammals all began with an ability for both sexes to feed the young. Who knows? At some point, the mammary gland or the nipple on the male became useless, or maybe it was never useful. It just evolved sort of spontaneously in both sexes. But it's not such a problem for them that if a new baby boy popped up with no nipples, there's no reason he would thrive in his environment at the expense of boys with nipples. So there's no reason that it should triumph, that particular gene for nipplelessness.
Right. Wouldn't it be nice, though, if both sexes could feed the young?
Oh, wouldn't it be grand?
Yes.
There are a few cultures where females do breastfeed, but then leave the infants with the males and they go hunt prey.
Uh-huh.
But it's quite rare.
Huh. And let's go back to the hair for a minute, because when you look at the male and female body, we have hair in different places, and you know, men have many times hair on their back and hair on their chest. Why is that?
Well, that actually differs from culture to culture. So when you see that kind of difference in physical appearance in a species, so some races of humans have more body fur. And when I say race, I mean you could call a race anything from like people of Northern European descent or people of Central African. It could be a separate race, the way biologists might use the term. So different groups of people have evolved different fur patterns, some having very little fur whatsoever other than on the head, and some having quite a lot. And the best explanation when you end up with such a diversity is that the sexual selection has been at work, and that it strictly reflects what females in that group preferred. So if you happen to evolve in a culture where the females like a lot of fur on their males, then the males will become more furry.
Oh, interesting.
And in another culture where it's considered unattractive, and people have always had strong reactions to hair, then males will evolve to have less hair.
Huh. Isn't that interesting? Yeah, I was listening. I guess I'd never heard this before. Maybe I've just been out of the loop. I was listening to some of the football players being interviewed, talking about, many of them have long hair now
Yeah.
And I was wondering, why would you have long hair being a football player? I think it would get in your way and somebody could hurt you and grab your hair, even inadvertently or inadvertently grab your hair. And the guy was responding by saying, it's a warrior thing. It's like you're putting on your dress. It's people in ancient times had a lot of hair because there you are. You're virile. You're masculine. You're a warrior.
Interesting response, but not accurate.
Huh.
For ancient Egyptians were a good example of the hair-hating cultures. A lot of people throughout the ages have thought that hair is sort of disgusting. And Egyptians were among the people who just got rid of it all, shaved it all off, and wore wigs.
Huh.
We see this in Central American cultures, South American cultures, too, sometimes, where body hair is considered revolting, and the hair on the head is kept very short. In parts of Africa, hair is kept very short. So it's really very cultural, and it has to do with the stories that we grew up with.
Hmm. Interesting. Oh, we have so much more to talk about. We'll take phone calls. And here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. Hannah Holmes is our guest. Her book is The Well-Dressed Ape, A Natural History of Myself. And, of course, by that she means human beings. Just been published by Random House. So lines are open for you. We have a couple callers, but feel free to take one. If you always wondered about some part of the human body and why we have it. And the book also looks at other species on Earth and some of the differences, the similarities, it's just a fascinating read. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We also can use email today. We have somebody checking the email, so if you want to do that, which somebody already has, that's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. We start our calls with Susan from Milwaukee. Hello, Susan.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a non-scientist, and from my rudimentary understanding of evolution, it seems that these changes develop with a combination of chance in genetics and also a lot of time. And I think that, in the evolution versus creationism debate, I think that a lot of more people could be convinced as a layperson, I can't understand the vastness of the amount of time that is required to make those changes. And I guess if you could, give a perspective to us that could help us understand that, yes, this is enough time for these changes to very slowly and gradually take place. And then secondarily, if you can also address how it is that evolution is science. I hear so often that, you cannot refute science with evolution, because it's been proven. If you could address those, either one of those or both, I would appreciate it. It would help me understand the concept of evolution more, and I'm going to take your response off the air.
All right, Susan, thanks.
Hi. excuse me. Two great examples of evolution in action and how long it takes. Actually, not as long as you might think. The cane toad, this big fat blob of a toad, was taken to Australia to control some agricultural pest about 50 years ago. 50 years, so that's 50 generations for the toad. In 50 generations, it has mutated sufficiently that there is now a group of toads who have longer legs, and they jump further. And they are at the front of the expansion wave of this species into this new ecosystem. So in 50 years, this animal has evolved to better exploit its habitat, and it is thriving as a result of that mutation.
Hmm.
Just 50 generations. So look at humans now. Maybe four or five, we're not really sure how many thousand years ago, humans got to the Tibetan Plateau, Lhasa, 3 miles in the air, really high. And in however many generations that is, if you say there are four generations in 100 years and 40 in 1,000, and in 5,200 generations, so four times longer than the toad, the people of Tibet have evolved different blood chemistry and different lung function so that they can do just as much work with much less oxygen as you can at sea level.
Oh.
So evolution works a little faster than you might think. And it happens just by, as you said, accident. Currently in Tibet, a decent percentage of the females have a mutation that puts more blood, more oxygen in each blood cell, and thus better feeds each cell. The offspring of these females with this mutation are much likely, or much more likely to live. However, the death rate for babies of the women who don't have this mutation is enormous.
Really?
So these genes are being weeded out of that population at a rapid rate because those offspring die. They do not carry on that low oxygen gene.
Let's go to Dee from Green Bay next. Hi, Dee.
Good morning, ladies.
Hi.
I am so excited about this program. I have a question and a comment, and first my comment. The popular culture, we talked about the theory of communication, the differences between women and men. And the theory in popular culture is that men don't speak as much in a quantitative fashion, and women have to speak twice as often because men don't listen, and we have to repeat it two or three times. All right, that's a joke, really. It's a joke. I don't mean that. Secondly, my question is do you, I'm sorry about not remembering her name, but the author of
Hannah.
The book, which I'm, Anna.
Hannah.
Hannah.
Mm-hmm.
Hannah, I really would like to know whether or not you, as a scholar, and, you know, having done considerable investigative research on Native people, whether or not worldwide you would consider people who have a land-based culture indicators of an indicator species of the quality and degradation of the land, the water, and the air that we breathe. And I'll listen to your comments off the air.
Thanks, Dee.
That's an interesting question. An indicator species is typically a sort of sensitive, like the canary in the coal mine, who indicates that things are going to heck in a handbasket and we better do something. The human makes a really bad indicator species because it's exceptional at adapting through tool use and new behaviors to changes in its environment. We are better at this than any living thing. Consider our closest relatives, the chimpanzees and the orangutans. These guys can only manage to live in tropical forests. They have to have tall trees to nest in at night. They have to have fruit. They have to have shade. Cut down those forests and those animals are out of the game. They can't improvise. Mm-hmm. They just don't have the brain power. They don't have the tools. The human, so closely related, has enough tools and wits to temporarily and then permanently adapt to almost any ecosystem on Earth. What that means, in addition to the fact that we've taken over the planet, is that we can adapt to a changing ecosystem without moving. So we make a fairly poor indicator species, except that we do indicate through our vast numbers that the ecosystem is working very well for us.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email, Hannah. I'm very excited to read this book. I'm a little jealous because I always wanted to write something like this, or at least thought it was a great idea for a book. I have tons of questions of what makes us humans such successful animals and where we're heading. Do you touch on our evolution to what we are and where our evolution is heading? If so, where are we heading?
In some ways, the human has changed the rules of the evolution game from strictly biological-based evolution to cultural evolution, because it's through our long history of tool use and each generation of humans using the tools from the generation before and improving on them that we are managing to overcome so many of what would be weaknesses in the animal if we were in sort of a wild habitat. So you can be born blind in this culture and use tools to be just as productive and fulfilled and reproductively happy as anyone else. Our tools have an amazing ability. Just look at fertility treatments. We have
sure,
a huge class of humans now who, in the wild, so to speak, would not be able to reproduce, and therefore their genes would exit the gene pool. But we are tinkering
and through cultural evolution, we're maintaining strains of humans in the gene pool who can't naturally reproduce. So we are evolving in that way. For whatever it's worth, that's how the human tends to evolve these days.
Mm-hmm. Are there any, you talk about how pitifully armed we are when you look at the naked human being. You mentioned our fingernails and our teeth, and they're both fairly benign. Are we dangerous in any way? Are there other species who consider us dangerous just on the basis of how we're built, what we look like?
Oh, yeah. Most animals, including the human, are hardwired to recognize physical postures in other animals as dangerous. We all know what a cat looks like when it's mad as opposed to when it's happy.
Mm-hmm.
We can recognize that without thinking about it. We know, do not put your hand down there.
Right.
Same with a dog, the same with a wolf or a bear. There are certain postures in all animals that telegraph their state of mind. And so, yeah, most wild animals can recognize that when a human has both eyes fixed on that wild animal, it's probably in predatory mode. It's just an instinctive interpretation.
Hmm.
Predators have both eyes at the front of the face, so they can gauge distance really well. And I see this just with my crows in the backyard. They'll tolerate me puttering around and gardening as long as I don't look directly at them.
Mm-hmm.
But the minute I turn my head, they fly up.
Oh, interesting. Let's go to Tanya next from Dousman. Hi, Tanya.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was listening earlier, and she talked about the male having nipples and the female having nipples. And I have a son in my family who was born with an extra nipple, and the doctor said it's right in the nipple line. That's what it is. And he said it's fairly common, and in fact, sometimes human beings will have four nipples, and in common in the line, just like other mammals do. And I wondered if she could speak to that at all about the use of it in humans at this point, or why it would occur, like my son has three nipples, not four. It's not symmetrical.
Hmm. Is he self-conscious about that, Tanya?
No, he actually isn't. He kind of shows it to the kids when they come, and he'll say, well, this is what I've got. It's extra. And, mm-hmm. and they go, oh, Mom, look at that. You know?
Hannah?
Yeah, it is quite common in boys and girls, actually. And it's a reminder that we did evolve from other phases of mammals. So, you know, my dog has eight nipples, and many mammals have eight or 10 or 12 or six. And those genes are still sort of buried in the human genome. They're a little bit deteriorated and altered and so on. But the reproduction of a human is such a complicated process in terms of copying all those genes. The odd little accidents happen. And they're a cool little reminder that we do have a nipple line, just like, you know, a squirrel or a bear. The sort of structure is buried deeply in there, just as a whale retains the skeletal structure of, like, back legs. Again, evolution doesn't get rid of things unless they're expensive. So the whale has no need to get rid of those skeletal legs. They're not a problem, so they just continue. A lot of us species just sort of doodle along with extra pieces and parts as long as they don't get in the way.
Thank you so much for the call. There's so much in the book. I want to go from place to place, and we can always go back. I found this fascinating and read aloud, of course, last night, that colorblind humans can negotiate a universe of beige in which you say you are rudderless. And the reason I never knew that, and the reason for it is interesting.
Well, they speculate that the reason is that the human evolved in a very beige world. If you think about savanna in the dry period of the year, the grass is beige, the animals are beige, the trees are kind of gray and beige, and the dirt itself is brownish beige. There's not a huge amount of color variety there, but it's very important to pick out the predators and the prey in that beige landscape. and if they're all shades of beige, that's going to be tough for somebody with normal three-color eyesight. But apparently, it's something that people with two-color eyesight are exceptional at.
Huh. Isn't that interesting? Let's go next to Kevin from Platteville. Hi, Kevin.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi.
Thank you for having me on.
Mm-hmm.
I had one comment. There was a lady who called in about amounts of time required for evolution, and your guest said that evolution happens much faster. I'm thinking that she's probably made the mistake of confusing microevolution, our speaker, microevolution with macroevolution. For example, the cane toad, however long its legs goes, is still a cane toad, still the same species, able to crossbreed with the previous cane toads it came from. The same with these people who, you know, live in the mountains. They're still humans, same genetic code, still human beings. Whereas the real evolution is really changing of the whole DNA pattern. And, I mean, these are still people. Evolution is getting cats from dogs or vice versa. I've done some mathematics with figures I've seen, and it seems to me that these random changes require thousands or maybe millions of Earth lifetimes, including from the molten, so-called molten state. So really, the evolution question, she really didn't answer that, Darwinian evolution. My other question is, I've heard a certain philosophy thinking that people of different colored skin on the planet came from interbreeding with apes. I'm thinking your guest ought to be well studied on whether or not there's any study of the DNA between any apes and human beings to indicate that there's any type of remote possibility this could have happened within the past, say, 10,000 years. I know there's the same number of chromosomes, but that's really a superficial thing. How about some real studies? Anything to indicate the possibility of crossbreeding?
Okay, thanks for the call.
Yeah, whether it's micro or macro, it's all evolution. It's a process of the genome mutating and spinning off a new model of the animal. It doesn't matter what scale it's on. It's a bit arbitrary to say it's finally evolution when you get one that can't breed, because often the case is that if you get one that can't, you know, you get a new model of antelope that can't breed with the old model. What often happens, most of the time, is that that one can't breed with anything, and it goes that sort of new species, so to speak, goes extinct before it gets started. So evolution is a mutation-by-mutation process, and it's happening all the time in all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, colored skin and apes sounds like pure blahooey to me. We have certainly not been compatible with apes for many, many hundreds of thousands of years. If we were able to interbreed with apes 10,000 years ago, then we would certainly be able to do it today. That's not long enough to create much of a difference. But the only experiment we know of in that regard was a rather comical undertaking by Stalin, who thought that a chimpanzee-human cross, a hybrid, would be the perfect military soldier.
Oh, my gosh.
So he actually commissioned a crazy guy to try to interbreed chimps and humans.
Stalin did this? I never knew this.
Yes.
Huh.
You know, we've all wondered, could humans mate with chimps?
Right.
Don't tell me you haven't wondered.
Not very much, but I am now.
It's a horrible thought. But anyway, he thought they'd be fabulous on the battlefield.
Oh, gee. Wow.
Because chimps are so tough and humans are so smart, it would be grand.
Yeah, it would be just grand. So how do you explain, you spend some time in the book talking about, you know, why you're so pale and people who live closer to the equator tend to have darker skin. Is it because of the sun? Is there some other factor here? How do you take that on?
Yeah, the best theory to date says it has nothing to do with skin cancer. That was the old theory, that humans initially evolved in equatorial Africa and places where there was a great deal of sunshine, and we evolved from animals with dark skin, presumably because most other apes also have dark skin. That would suggest that the ancestor species was dark-skinned. But as the animals spread out, it discovered, sort of biologically speaking, again, with mutations, that the animals with paler skin did better in places where there was little sunlight, because that pale skin allowed more ultraviolet radiation to get into the animal and create vitamin D, which we need.
Mm-hmm.
So the human skin turned more pale as it moved out of the sunny areas. And the recent work that's been done on this is fascinating. It actually says skin color is striking a balance between vitamin D and a B vitamin called folate, which can be destroyed by ultraviolet radiation. So you actually need to find the balance point where you can keep both those nutrients in good supply without zapping the other one.
Oh, that's interesting. So what should we be? What's ideal?
It depends. This is what their data showed, is that it has little to do with heat and warmth. It has everything to do with cloudiness.
Ah.
So if you were in a cloudy area, you need to have paler skin, whether you're at the equator or at the North Pole. If you're in a sunnier area, again, whether you're on a mountaintop or in a valley, you need to have the darker skin.
Let's go next to Craig from La Crosse is next. Our number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. Hi, Craig.
Hi there. Very good show today. I do have to say as a preliminary comment, I don't believe in evolution. I believe the biblical account of creationism. But aside from that, I just want to get that out of the way. Your guest does seem very knowledgeable on the biology of creatures, human beings, and animals. And going back to the topic of men having nipples, it seems like I heard many years ago that if a father becomes especially close to his baby, some men have been recorded or documented to have been able to lactate. Have you found any of this out in some of your research?
I've never seen peer-reviewed science on that, and that's what I base all my work on. I don't ever use anything less stringent than something that's been published in an academic journal. However, I just on a sort of instinct would not rule it out, for the same reason that we can pop up a third or fourth nipple. The gear may be there, sort of saved over millions of years. The genetic gear may be there for a few males in the population to actually produce some milk. It's a very complicated system, and so I would suggest that if it did occur, it would be extremely rare, because it relies on a whole suite of hormones that are usually regulated by your gonads, and those are quite different between the male and the female.
Mm-hmm.
But again, because the animal is so complicated and it retains so much antiquated DNA from all of its mammalian ancestry, I really wouldn't rule it out.
Thanks for the call. Let's talk about our eyesight for a moment. You mentioned the animals on Earth that can really see 360 degrees, and as I was reading that, I was thinking, well, wouldn't that be a good idea for all of us?
It's fabulous, isn't it?
Yes.
There's a few, I mean, and the human is very predatory in its alignment of its eyes. They're both facing frontwards so that you can get binocular vision, really good depth perception. That's common when you look at predators like lions and your cat. You know, they look at you with both eyes. They know exactly where you are and how far they have to jump to bite you. But with prey animals like rabbits or birds, the eyes go onto the side of the head so that they have a much wider view of the world. They have very little, if any, binocular vision, so their depth perception is terrible.
Mm.
But they can see both sides of them from both sides at once, which is hard to even imagine.
Yes, it is.
And there's a few species who put the eyes so far back on the head that they have binocular vision behind them.
Oh, my gosh.
Which I just find fascinating.
Yeah, I do, too. It's interesting to imagine what our lives would be like if we could see that way. We got to pause for a moment. We'll return. 800-486-8655. The author of The Well-Dressed Ape, A Natural History of Myself, Hannah Holmes, is with us. Book just published by Random House, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return now to your phone calls to Caroline from Madison. Hi.
Hi, good morning.
Hello.
Hi, my husband made a comment the other night that I thought was pretty interesting, and I forget how it came up, but he was mentioning that really, you know, men, their primary role for thousands of years was to defend territory and their families and to hunt for game. And when you look at societies like ours and how we've evolved, their values slowly erupting in terms of they don't have to worry about defending, you know, their families and land every single day, and they're not out hunting game because women are working and earning money and providing food for their families. And it's, you know, what does that mean in terms of their role, you know, 50 years from now or 100 years from now?
Hannah?
Yeah, poor things.
Mm-hmm.
They've been forced into really redefining their role in the last 10,000 years since we started building cities and specializing in various tasks. It's interesting that males overwhelmingly are still the sex that goes hunting for prey, for live prey. It seems to be something they really enjoy. Hmm. And females are increasingly becoming hunters, mm-hmm. but for the most part, it's a bit of a fringe thing for females to this day. A friend of mine has suggested that the female, who used to do a lot of foraging, and in many of these hunter-gatherer cultures today, females bring in just as many calories as males. They just do it from more stationary food sources, fruits and tubers and even small mammals, small animals. So this friend of mine suggests that for females without a foraging job to do, shopping has become the modern
substitute. Oh, my gosh, shopping. Wow.
You know, we go digging through the rows and the racks, and we find wonderful things, and it's very fulfilling to have sort of brought home a treasure.
Oh, that's what an interesting thought. Well, the number of hunters, didn't I read something this fall, though, the number of hunters has really been going down?
Yeah, the number of animals has been going down.
Right.
The number of places where you can shoot a gun is what's actually going down. So people have to travel further and further to exercise that predatory role. This is something that I treated in my last book, Suburban Safari. We've put cordons around our settlements and said you can't fire guns here. And it doesn't take an animal very long to figure out that the best-tasting rhododendrons and pansies also happen to be in this gun-free zone. So we're running over the prey now instead of shooting them.
Oh, isn't that interesting? Here's an interesting email, Hannah. When you were talking about the way men and women navigate spaces, I've realized it makes a big difference when looking at career choices. I'm a woman and was thinking about going into physical therapy. One of the deterrents for me is realizing how much spatial, three-dimensional thinking is involved in this field, because there are many women in this field and in others that require spatial thinking. I'm curious about understanding these sorts of differences in the brain functioning of men and women might affect education and how things are taught in classes. Are you aware of ways that understanding these biological differences in brain structure might affect education environments and the way that curriculum is presented?
Well, the bad news is we know very little about this. We're just seeing the tip of the iceberg right now in terms of research on how these differences manifest. So we really don't know a lot. The brain is in large part uncharted territory. The good news is that what little evidence we do have is that each sex can learn to compensate through experience. So I'm an excellent example of this. I used to be dreadful at navigating, and I always needed a map, and I would stand on street corners for an hour turning the thing another 6 degrees and another, which is north.
Another feeling, right?
Oh, it's horrible. But I've traveled enough now that I really have a very well evolved skill to do it. I don't mean evolution, but
right.
I've developed compensating mechanisms. I can do it now. And that's what we're finding, is that even these differences that are biologically based can be overcome because the human brain is so flexible and so able to learn.
Hmm. Thanks for your email and call. Let's go next to Michael from Hillsburg. Hi, Michael.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm rather in agreement with Kevin from Platteville, Ms. Holmes. He brought up the subject of microevolution versus macroevolution. I would take it one step further and submit that what you described with the cane frogs and the people living on the Tibetan Plateau is simply a variation in species, and it goes nowhere toward the macroevolutionary question involved of going from one species to another. It seems to me that it's illogical, inconsistent, and absolutely unscientific to insist that microevolution or variation in species is the same thing as macroevolution, because there are no examples of that in the world we live in. You've been allowed to call an apple an orange, when I think you should call apples apples and orange oranges. And if indeed you can't go there, it all sounds like pure bluey to me.
I'm curious to know how you would ever get to speciation, which these callers are talking about. Speciation is when the dog becomes so different from its predecessors that it can no longer have viable offspring with them. That's speciation, or what these folks are calling macroevolution. There's no way to get to macroevolution without what they're calling microevolution. So we don't just noodle along as humans and then get zapped by ultraviolet radiation and the entire genome changes and suddenly we are a generation of whatever, cane toads. Evolution doesn't work that way. It works in tiny little steps. And these tiny little steps are occurring all the time in every living thing. So you don't get to macroevolution without microevolution. If the people of the Tibetan Plateau stayed in isolation from all other humans for another who knows how many million years it would take, they would probably eventually become a species of their own, unable to reproduce successfully with other humans. That's how the micro alterations in DNA add up to become a new species.
Hmm. Interesting. Hey, let's talk about, because a lot of people listening to us right now have back problems or their knees are hurting or they've had hip replacements, those parts of our bodies that don't seem to work very well, maybe because we stand up all the time. What are the problems? Why do so many of us suffer from these joints not working well? And is there any relief down the road?
Yeah, we could use some evolution in that category,
right,
couldn't we? One of the problems with the human is that it was built as a four-legged animal and evolved a two-legged lifestyle. Why? We're not sure. There's some interesting theories about the animal needing to move faster to get to carrion on the plains of Africa. So there are a variety of possible explanations. My favorite involves throwing, because, again, to go back to the human's weapon system, it's laughable. But the human developed really good aim with thrown objects. And this is important because now you can kill prey and combat other humans without having to get close to them and biting and fighting. But to throw really well, you need freedom of rotation between the torso and the bottom of the body.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my own personal blahooey theory for why the human stood up. But it's still kind of adjusting. We did pretty well with the top end of the animal because the spinal column had to shift from the back of the skull down to the bottom of the skull. In your dog or cat, the spinal column goes right into the back of the skull. So over time, we evolved to get the head in balance over the shoulders and a really nice system of stabilization that allows us to keep that beautiful predator vision going, even while we're sprinting. Really an amazing work. But as you get lower in the animal, you get to those hip joints and knee joints that take a pounding every day,
right,
the entire weight of the animal on two little legs, and the bones are stacked up straight on top of each other, it's just not quite perfect yet.
Yes.
And so anytime you have bones that bang against each other over time, they're going to burn through the cushion and start hitting each other directly, and that causes new bone growth called arthritis.
Yeah.
But we see it in other animals, too. All animals are subject to that same rule of bone disturbance and regrowth. So it's a fact of life for all of us.
Mm-hmm. What were the animals you were specifically mentioning in the book? Was it whales or something that had arthritis?
Even whales get arthritis. That seems so unfair. You know,
right,
we're all told that swimming is the most healthy exercise we can do because it's so low impact, it shouldn't bang your skeleton around.
Right.
But a whale who died in the Thames River a year or two ago, was autopsied, and he had arthritis where his skull joined his spinal column.
Oh.
Why that should be is interesting to speculate about.
Right. Well, thank you, Hannah, so much. I love the book. It's just really well-written and very, very interesting and well-researched. Thank you so much for being
with us. Oh, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Hannah Holmes, our guest this hour. The book is The Well-Dressed Ape, A Natural History of Myself. Hannah is the author also of Suburban Safari and The Secret Life of Dust. She's written for The New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Discover Outside, and many other publications, and does a lot of work on nature subjects and science for the Discovery Channel online. We thank her for being with us to talk about the just-released book. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thank you to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Kathleen Dunn. It's a minute now before 11 on this Thursday morning, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.